Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. I thought the best way to start is by a little background who St. Patrick is, all about St. Patrick. St. Patrick was born to Catholic parents about 385 in Britain. His father was a nobleman and a deacon, but Patrick's privileged life came to an end at age 16 when he was captured by slave raiders from Ireland. With a large group of prisoners, he was transported to the then pagan island. Sold as a slave to a king in the northeast, Patrick had the lonely task of tending the pigs and sheep. In the midst of these harsh living conditions, Patrick's faith flourished as he turned to God in prayer. After being held captive for 6 years, he heard a voice in his sleep say, "Soon you will go back to your homeland." A short time later, he heard the same voice say, "Your ship is ready." Trusting in God, Patrick set out on a 200-mile journey through unknown territory. When he arrived at the ship, the captain at first refused to take him. But Patrick prayed to God for help, and the captain changed his mind. Then began a lifetime of dedicating his life to becoming a priest. He envisioned returning to Ireland to teach the Irish about Christianity. During his 30 years in Ireland, Patrick founded more than 300 churches and baptized more than 120,000 people. Yet he still encountered much opposition. "Daily I expect either murder, robbery, or enslavement," he wrote in his confessions. He escaped from 12 attempts on his life and died a natural death on March 17th, 461. By the end of the 7th century, many legends had developed about him. One, of course, says he charmed all the snakes in Ireland and led them to the sea to drown. Another, probably the most popular, is that he used the three-leafed shamrock to explain the concept of the Holy Trinity to unbelievers. This is probably why shamrocks, now Ireland's national flower, are worn by the Irish on St. Patrick's Day. And on St. Patrick's breastplate is written, "Christ be with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, Christ in the heart of everyone who thinks of me, everyone who speaks of me, Christ in every eye that sees me, and Christ in every ear that hears me." So, the story of St. Patrick. And I don't want to forget to get the word out on Chicago's most romantic restaurant, Gaia's Cafe, honors National Proposal Day with a special proposal class. Having assisted couples with more than 500 engagements, Jeff Lawler, a good pal, Chicago's most romantic man, offers his guidance on planning the perfect proposal on National Proposal Day with wine, cheese, and more. Ready to pop the question? Gaia's Cafe proprietor, Jeff Lawler, has surely earned his title of most romantic man. Through the years, with the creation of over 500 engagements, in celebration of his knowledge and love of love, Gaia's Cafe will host a proposal class in honor of National Proposal Day on Wednesday, March 20th from 3 to 7 p.m. Men and women looking to propose can stop by for a sip and dip and a meet and greet with Jeff on planning the ultimate moment. Those searching for the perfect engagement idea finally have the chance to hear all things romance and finally pop the question in a memorable, creative fashion. Gaia's Cafe and our good friend Jeff Lawler, Wednesday, March 20th, from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. And, of course, Gaia's is located at 340 West Armitage in Chicago. And I'm sure if you mention our name, well, I don't know what he'll do, but no, I'm sure he'll buy you the first glass of wine is on Gaia's. He's our good friend. We always enjoy chatting with him about Valentine's Day. And now, his great idea about National Proposal Day. And continuing our St. Patrick's Day celebration, one of my favorite songs, my grandfather used to always sing this to us. And this is sung by one of Chicago's great female vocalists, Catherine O'Connell from St. Thomas More Parish. Danny Boy. And we'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen, on down the mountainside. The summer's gone, and all the leaves are falling. Tis you must go, and I must bide. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed and white with snow. For I'll be here in sunshine or in shadow. Oh, Danny boy, oh, Danny boy, I love you so. And if you come when all the flowers are dying, and I am dead, as dead I well may be, I know you'll find the place where I am lying, and kneel and say an ave there for me.
O'Connell singing one of his favorites, Danny Boy. And we're back on The Kevin Moore Show. I think the best way to begin an introduction of our very esteemed first guest here is from a quote by Janet Maslin from the New York Times. She said, "The Winslow effect is to fuse the grave and the playful, the body blow and the joke, the nightmare and the pipe dream. It's flippant and dead serious simultaneously." Don Winslow concludes his New York Times best-selling Cartel trilogy, which began in 2005 with The Power of the Dog and continued in 2015 with the breakout book The Cartel, with the highly anticipated publication of The Border, which is now available. The trilogy, massive in scope and ambition, follows a DEA agent, Art Keller, on a harrowing 45-year journey through America's longest-running war, the War on Drugs. Shocking in its brutality, raw in its humanity, it portrays Mexican cartel power struggles, the narcos and cops on both sides of the border, the traffickers and drug mules, lawyers, journalists, junkies, teenage hitmen, children seeking asylum, and political corruption from the poppy fields in Mexico to the White House. The three novels have been praised by the New York Times, saying, "You don't read these books, you live them." National Public Radio says, "Shakespeare for our times," and the Arizona Republic, "quite simply the most important crime saga in modern literature." The landmark trilogy has made Winslow a central figure in the national debate over border security, the handling of migrant children, the opioid crisis, and the influence of foreign money on the highest levels of U.S. government. The Border, a shattering tale of vengeance, violence, corruption, and justice, this last novel in Don Winslow's magnificent award-winning internationally best-selling trilogy is packed with unforgettable drawn-from-the-headline scenes. Shocking in its brutality, raw in its humanity, The Border is an unflinching portrait of modern America, a story of and for our time. Don Winslow is the author of 20 acclaimed award-winning international bestsellers, including the New York Times bestseller and sensation The Force, the number one international bestseller The Cartel, The Power of the Dog, Savages, and The Winter of Frankie Machine. Savages was made into a major film by three-time Oscar-winning writer-director Oliver Sohn. A film adaptation of The Cartel is scheduled to begin production in 2019. A former investigator, anti-terrorist trainer, and trial consultant, Don Winslow lives in California and Rhode Island. On the line with us right now is Don Winslow. Don, an honor to have you on the show.
An honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Don. Every time I turn on the TV, I see you somewhere and certainly talking about something that's just on top of everybody's mind. And I will apologize in advance, Don, for probably asking questions that you've answered many times before. But nonetheless, we can still kind of talk about them. And I was thinking, how do I begin this that somebody else hasn't begun? I guess I got to say, when did this all start? I mean, we can go back, I guess, maybe, I imagine you say the Egyptians maybe did some kind of drug-induced whatever they had. But when did this all start?
The whole drug thing?
Yeah.
You know, there are references to opium, of course, in the Odyssey.
Right, okay.
So it goes back to one of the world's first literary works. You know, we have references to the lotus eaters. So really, it's been with us forever, you know, in various iterations.
Sherlock Holmes did opium, I think.
Sherlock Holmes did cocaine.
Cocaine, okay.
The famous 7% solution.
Right,
actually,
right.
I got thrown out of 8th grade English class for making that observation.
Must have been a nun.
I was just past the nun.
Okay.
By the way, I every time I turn on the TV, I see myself too. I think I threw a pair of rolled up socks at it the other night in a hotel room.
You know, you think back of the Far East, which had the opium and the poppy fields and so forth, and you're certainly a student of that. But when did it really start getting bad in the United? Let's say just kind of, I guess, the United States. I guess we could say that
post World War II.
Okay, post World War II, really not before that. Okay.
Yeah, listen, we had those drugs before.
Sure,
then.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
We have cocaine laws as old as 1919. We have anti-opium laws around the same time, anti-marijuana laws. But if you really want to look at when the drug problem got really serious in the United States, you're talking post-World War II.
Okay.
You're talking, you know, a massive migration from the rural South to the industrial north, including, of course, Chicago, and a lot of dislocation, a lot of racism. You're looking at soldiers and sailors and Marines coming home with wounds that required morphine.
Okay.
And by the way, in those days, during World War II, the American government went down to Sinaloa, Mexico, asking them to grow more opium.
Really?
There are narrow gauge railroad tracks coming out of the Sierra Madres that were built by the United States because we had lost our morphine source because of German U-boats blocking off, you know, southern Asia, the Japanese blocking off the, you know, the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. And we desperately needed this raw opium to produce morphine. And so we went down and asked them to please grow more morphine. As soon as the war ended, we went down and said, please stop growing that opium. But the American mob, in fact, it was Benny Siegel, Bugsy Siegel, who went down and said, yeah, it's okay, we'll buy as much as you can produce. So it's really after World War II we begin to see a serious drug problem in the United States. Sorry, that was a lengthy answer.
No, it was a wonderful answer. I didn't realize all that was happening. And then it just becomes a domino effect from there.
Well, it does. And, of course, you know, drug trends shift and change. You know, some drugs become popular, if you will, and dominant, and then others kind of take their place. So, you know, for a long time, the problem really was heroin and its derivatives. Mm-hmm. And then in the late 80s and early 90s, it was cocaine, you know, crack cocaine, famously, in, you know, in the inner cities, and powdered cocaine among the more affluent.
And, of course, this gets spread out because of the economic advantages of it. It spreads around. We're having, of course, Chicago is probably top of the list of anybody in the United States but struggling with these issues.
Well, Chicago is a hub. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, it's the major transportation hub for the Midwest. And so, like any other product, it's going to find the hub to then be distributed outward. So Los Angeles, New York, Chicago are where most of the heroin, you know, is shipped to. And then it's busted down into smaller units and, you know, just like any other product, really, and then directed outward.
And this isn't limited to lower income. This is also affluent people that are involved in
this. Well,
it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course that's when it gained national attention. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. we didn't have a heroin or opioid epidemic until, you know, upper middle class and affluent people started dying.
And now opioids are the scourge of what we're experiencing day in and day out.
They are, although my sources tell me, and DEA seems to back it up, that cocaine is now making a comeback. So you're going to see that rising again.
It's kind of ironic. You and I are close to the same age, and yep. After playing sports all my life, I had this surprise. Well, you need a new hip. Okay, well, fine.
Right.
So we go and get a new hip, and of course, the first week, I'm on those opioids, you know. And
sure.
I said, after a week, I said to my wife, I said, honey, take these and flush them down the toilet because it's making me nutty.
And, yeah, they're too good.
You know, and then, you know, but now it's, you don't need a new hip to enjoy them. And this is what's a mass produced now, you know.
Well, this is the problem that we're really not, in my opinion, not really looking at. Opioids are always a response to pain. And thank God,
yeah.
You know, you just went through it. People with terminal diseases,
yeah.
Thank God for these things. You know, fentanyl was designed for terminal cancer patients, basically. But we are 5% of the world's population. We use 80% of the world's opioids.
Oh, boy.
Tell me that's all slip discs.
Yeah, that's a statistic.
Right.
Huh?
So the question that we're not asking is, what's the pain?
Yeah.
You know, if you go to a doctor, the first thing that he or she says is, where does it hurt?
Yeah.
What hurts?
Yeah.
Right? So if we're using these painkillers at such a massive rate, what's the pain? And until we answer that question, none of these other strategies is going to do much to affect the drug problem.
If you had a boatload of money, Dan, as much as you wanted... what would you do with it? How do you stop it? How do you control it? How do you make it better? How do you?
Well, the fact
or do
is
you?
We do have a boat. Yeah, I think there are things we can do. Mm-hmm. We do have a boatload of money, by the way. We're throwing it away on interdiction and prisons and equipment and judges and cops and lawyers and the sort of prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
To the tune of about $88 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and you know, and I might sound like some sort of old school liberal here, I'm kind of an old school blue or khaki collared Democrat, but that money would be much better spent in three areas. Treatment, which is hard for people to acquire now. Education. Do you know that 70% of people entering state prisons lack a high school education?
Really?
Mm. And economic development in areas that are underdeveloped, in these areas that have sort of rather famously in the media the past few years been left behind. And if we started doing that, we might see some relief. On the demand end, we will never solve this problem on the supply end. I don't care how much money you throw at it. I don't care how high the wall is or how deep or wide the wall is. As long as the demand is there, the supply will find its way to us.
Well, if there's no users anymore and we kind of eliminate those through education and economic development and treatment, then nobody will be buying the stuff either.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Listen, there will never be no users.
Sure.
I'm not an idealist or a dreamer in that sense. There's always going to be a certain percentage of any population that is going to want to escape their current reality, at least for a little while. And you started this conversation really with that. You know, this goes back to the Egyptians to the early Greeks, right?
Sure.
We've always, in some ways, sought intoxication. So that the problem is never completely going to go away. But we could certainly make it a lot better.
Well, those are the topics, of course, are on top of the minds of the Chicagoans because we have a mayoral election runoff that's coming up, and education and economic development, not only as it addresses to drugs, but also to the crime that we have in Chicago. But I guess one is kind of interconnected with the other, and that's how we end up with this.
Well, the criminality of drugs, by making them illegal, what you do is you take, by definition then, only criminals can deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
If only criminals can deal with them, there's no access to the justice system or to other social systems. And so if there's no access to the court systems, then there's only access to force and violence. If that's the case, then the most violent will eventually rise to the top. And that's what you see in the creation of the Mexican cartels, and that's what you see on the violent street corners. You know, you don't see, you know, Budweiser and Coors slugging it out with machine guns.
Yeah.
Because it's legal.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see rival cigarette companies going at each other because it's legal. But those two products probably kill more people than all the other illicit drugs combined.
Could you legalize cocaine and heroin? Could you do that?
Yeah.
Hey, it's a rhetorical question, I guess, but...
No, I don't think it's a rhetorical question. I take it as a very pragmatic question.
Yeah.
Yes. Look, you know, and everyone says, oh, my God, that's a radical idea.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Yeah. But I think it's radical to spend $88 billion a year to make things worse. I think it's radical to have 2.2 million people in jails. 50% of federal prisoners are there for drug charges, 20% of state prisoners are there for drug charges, and 85% of the people who are checked into your city or county jail every night test positive for drugs.
Mm.
All of that's happened while drugs are illegal. Every horror story you can tell me has happened while drugs are illegal.
Yeah.
It's not working. So let's try something different. And if we took the criminality out of this issue, we do a number of positive things. One, we destroy the power of the cartels, to whom we now send about $65 billion a year in dirty money, which corrupts Mexican society, which has cost about now 200,000 Mexican lives lost in drug-related violence for the past 12 years, right? So we would take the profit motive out of it. And two, I think that if drugs were legalized, there are control mechanisms that we could put into place that some cities are starting to put in. Dayton, Ohio is having some success with this, for instance.
Oh, yes, right.
Cincinnati. Some other cities that can make it all safer and where people might be more amenable to seeking treatment.
Well, I guess that's a question that not too long ago was asked about marijuana. Could you do something about marijuana? Well, here we are. Now everybody's...
Yeah, here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
Yeah, here we are. You know, listen, I mean, marijuana in a de facto sense has been legalized for years.
Sure,
and years.
Sure.
But when three states legalized it officially, marijuana imports from Mexico dropped almost 40% overnight. They don't even grow this stuff anymore.
Really?
Now, the negative part of that, you know, the law of unintended consequences being what it is, they decided to make up that profit center for the loss of that profit center by growing more opium and then undercutting the pharmaceutical companies in the opioid market. So where, you know, it would take about $30 for the average addict, if, you know, if there is such a thing, to get high on Oxy or one of those pills,
mm-hmm.
the Mexicans created a powerful heroin that would get that person high for only
$10
because they had a ready-made market of opioid addicts in the United States. So that was the unintended consequence of marijuana legalization. it's also an argument why these sort of piecemeal approaches won't work as well as they might.
Will we see, based on what you just said, due to the fact that now that marijuana is being legalized in many of the states, and pretty soon probably quite a few of them, mm-hmm. we're going to, is that going to affect this whole conversation?
Eventually. You know, look, and I think that there are some negative aspects to marijuana legalization, although I am in favor of it, mm-hmm. obviously. You know, I think more people are doing it. I think you're going to find more, you know, people driving high as opposed to driving drunk. I don't think it's without problems, yeah. right? And I think some of the criticisms of it need to be taken seriously and measures taken about it. But the legalization of marijuana overall is not going to affect the major problems that we're suffering from. Heroin is a far more destructive drug, obviously, than marijuana. Cocaine is a far more destructive drug. Methamphetamine, a far more destructive drug. All of those are illegal. Cocaine and meth, you know, were on the downhill slide a few years ago. Now they're both making a comeback. So until we deal with those issues, you know, the marijuana will remain sort of a side issue.
You know, you mentioned the cartels, Don. Mm-hmm. Of course, in the news has been El Chapo and his conviction and so forth. Make any difference?
No.
None.
No.
Yeah.
Look, let me be really clear. I think that the conviction of Guzman, and I kind of resist calling him El Chapo because it sounds like sort of a cutesy Disney-esque nickname for, you know, a horrible guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the conviction is a good thing. You know, I mean, it's justice. This guy has done far worse things, by the way, than he was charged with mm-hmm. in an American court. And so hats off to the DEA and the cops and the prosecutors who achieved that. However, in terms of the overall drug situation, it made and will make no difference whatsoever. You know, A, he would not have been arrested and rearrested and captured and recaptured if he still had power.
Mm-hmm.
His own partners basically dished him up
mm-hmm.
because they were tired of his antics and tired of his greed, and you don't have time for me to go into all the details.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already over. He was a spent force by the time he's sitting in Lower Manhattan, you know, cell. So the, you know, drugs didn't slow down. The flow of drugs didn't slow down. And in fact, we had more fatal heroin overdoses since Guzman was captured than before.
And these cartels are still as strong and still as vigorous as they've ever been?
Yeah, well, they are and they aren't. I mean, look, the Sinaloa cartel, which was Guzman's outfit, was the dominant cartel. Then with his capture and that they went through some internal squabbling, which I think they've about worked out, other cartels came to power. And so the Sinaloa cartel is not as powerful. There's something called the New Generation Jalisco cartel, which is seriously challenging, and a lot of smaller DTOs, drug trafficking organizations, a.k.a. cartels, have either revived in the last two or three years or sprung up anew. But the kingpin strategy, that is, you know, capturing and arresting a Guzman or a Pablo Escobar or any of these guys, doesn't work because all you've done is create a job opening that people are very keen to fill and will do so violently, you know, to get that job. So Mexico has experienced its most violent years, which I did not think was possible, by the way, in the last 2 years. Since, you know, this internal squabbling and you know, the fight to fill that power vacuum has begun.
Then what does Mexico become other than having the drug cartels, which are an economic engine for the country?
Well, yeah, look, I mean, nobody knows the real numbers.
Sure.
Right? The cartels don't publish their, you know, tax returns. But somewhere between 7% and 12% of the Mexican economy comes from drugs, either directly or indirectly through drug money investment in the legitimate economy. So it's a serious issue. Again, though, the solution to the so-called Mexican drug problem is not in Mexico. It's in the United States and, to a lesser extent, Western Europe, the consumer countries.
Mm-hmm. How many years have you – when did you start getting interested in starting investing your time and researching this? Of course, that wasn't your initial background. And when did that change in your background?
September 1998.
Why?
The first thing I do in the morning when I get up, and I usually, you know, this is at 5, I start work at 5:30, but at 5 I'm on the newspapers, you know, I'm a newspaper junkie, and I always would start with the San Diego Union-Tribune, because it's my home paper, and this one morning I get up and I see that 19 innocent men, women, and children in a town not far across the border, I live quite close to the border, had been slaughtered in a drug-related massacre. And I could not get my head wrapped around how something like that could happen. At the time, I knew nothing and cared nothing, frankly, about the drug trafficking world. It was not at all interesting to me. But I was trying to find the cause of this. How could that happen? Now, mind you, 10 years later or a little less, 19 bodies in a day would not even have made the papers.
Yeah.
That was like a low daily body count.
Sure.
In Juarez and Tijuana and other places. But at that time, it was quite shocking. And so I started researching, and I guess, you know, when you're a novelist, if you do enough research, eventually you're going to start typing. And that's what I did. And now it's been a third of my life on this story.
Had you envisioned that a trilogy would evolve from this in such a way that it's become such a touchstone point with this issue?
No, quite the opposite. After each of the first two books, I swore I was not going to write another one. Life's funny, isn't it? After I wrote the first book was called The Power of the Dog, and after I wrote Dog, I said, yeah, I'm never going back to that world. I'm done.
Called you back.
What?
It called you back.
It did, you know. it was like, well, you know, I was sitting here again. We live, you know, quite close to Mexico. And watching what was going on down there in horror and disbelief. But understanding it. I now understood what the underlying causes were. And I had enough familiarity with the players and the dynamics that I thought, this is egotistical, but I thought I can explain this to a readership, albeit, you know, fictionally, what's going on and how this has come about. But I wasn't doing it. I was sitting on the sidelines. And I guess I felt a little guilty about it, you know. And finally I agreed to do that book, and that's a book called The Cartel. After Cartel... Same thing, you know, but I really thought the story was over. I thought the main protagonist is a guy named Art Keller, DEA guy. I thought his story was over. The Sinaloa cartel had sort of won the war. I thought that story was over. And, you know, once again, I was wrong.
Well, you had a lot to say because it took two strong men to bring the book into my house the other day.
It's a fat book. It's a little embarrassing, you know. I thought it was the shortest one. The publisher said, no, it's the longest. I said, no, you've done something with the type and the margins or something. I really thought that. You know, it had to be proven to me.
I don't want to belabor a cliche here, of course, and I don't even want to go into our chief executive because that's a whole other show by itself. But the border, the wall is on a topic on everybody's conversation list, you know.
Sure.
Useless, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, useless.
Yeah.
The reason why is so painfully obvious that a sixth grader would know it. The wall has gates. You know, there are now 52 points of entry. These are legal entry points on the Mexican-American border. There's three that really matter: San Diego, El Paso, and Laredo. That's where most of the drugs come through. So 90% of the illicit drugs come either mostly through tractor trailer trucks or private vehicles through those gates. So if you build that wall, you are not going to close those gates. You're just not. Mm-hmm. San Diego is the busiest commercial border crossing in the Western Hemisphere. Something like 5,000 tractor trailer trucks come across those ports of entry every day. In El Paso, an average of one every 15 seconds.
Wow.
So, and these are not my numbers. These are DEA numbers, but, you know, traffickers told us the same thing, by the way, testified to it in the Guzman trial. So everybody knows this. So in terms of stopping drugs, it will do absolutely nothing. In fact, it will make things worse because those other, you know, 10, 15%, whatever, it's a very low number of drugs that don't go through those crossings that are out in the deserts and the mountains where a wall might slow it down. All the wall would do is, those are small players, right? Those are the smaller organizations and independents. So what it will do is it will force them to go to the major cartels to use the major crossings that the cartels control. And they pay a tax to do it, usually somewhere between 5 and 7% of the value of the product. So, in fact, the wall would make the cartels more money.
Well, evidently, everybody doesn't know that, and I just don't know why people...
Well, our chief executive does know that. And I think what happened was that, you know, on the campaign trail, he was talking about this, and he told, you know, people in New Hampshire who, you know, suffered losses of kids from drug overdoses that he was going to fix it by building a wall. And I think he said that ignorantly, but now he knows better. And, you know, I just wish sometimes, you know, people had the ability to say, you know what, I've gotten better information.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in a position now where I get better intelligence and people have told me this isn't going to work. But obviously that hasn't happened. He's doubled down on it and, you know, and said that this 90% figure is a lie. Well, it's not a lie. It's reality.
I guess the most important question I can ask in our chat today is, why aren't people listening more closely to you, Dan? I don't know you have the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to it. Look, I go out and I talk to a lot of people, you know, on these book tours. You know, I meet people, you know, all the time. And I think that there is a groundswell of opinion that's changing on these topics. I really do. And I speak to, you know, conservatives. I had the other night, three Republicans. I mean, they identified themselves when they came up. You know, I'm a right winger. I'm a Republican. You know? And, but I agree about the wall. Mm-hmm. I agree about drug reform. I agree about criminal reform. It's two areas where the right and the left can meet and agree on something, because these really aren't right issues, left issues, Democrat Republican issues. They really aren't.
Yeah.
A gate is a gate. Sure. It's not a Republican gate or a Democratic gate.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And so, and these figures are the figures. And so you can talk to people on the right and say, is this really how you want to spend your tax money to make things worse? And then people on the left tend to take it not so much from a fiscal aspect, although they should, by the way, but from a sort of civil liberties aspect, you know. So I don't know who's listening. And, you know, once every year and a half or 2 years when I bring a book out, I have a very tiny window to where people might be listening to me on these issues. But I think that there is a changing groundswell of opinion. But it's coming from below. It's not coming from above.
Well, I'm glad at least we had a little time in your busy schedule to have people listen to what you had to say today. And I appreciate
you taking a little time. Thank you. Yeah.
Don Winslow's third book in his trilogy, The Border, A Shattering Tale of Vengeance, Violence, Corruption, and Justice. This last novel in Don Winslow's magnificent award-winning internationally best-selling trilogy is packed with unforgettable, drawn from the headline scenes, shocking in its brutality, raw in its humanity. The Border is an unflinching portrait of modern America, a story of and for our time. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning author, Don Winslow. Don, thanks for taking some time. It's been a very engaging conversation. I know we could go on forever, but we have a limited time.
And say hi to Chicago for me.
Yeah, please come and visit us for in your next book, maybe.
I come there a lot, actually. I really like Chicago.
Well, you have my number, so please call
and
we'll.
I'll give you a ring.
Yeah, we'd like to see you. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, that'd be great. My pleasure. Thanks for your
Thank you, Don. Don Winslow, the best-selling author of The Border. A lot of interesting conversations. There's certainly food for thought, and not as encouraging as you'd like, but there's always hope, right? The Border, now available from Don Winslow. A little poem about We're All Irish for a Day from Kevin McCarthy in South Holland. Kevin writes, I've never kissed the Blarney Stone, but Blarney's in my blood, although my sainted mum tried hard to nip it in the bud. I'll sing you honest stories or of how life has made me wise, and then my wife can tell you that, well, they're all a pack of lies. To tell the truth, the Guinness is too bitter on my tongue, but who'd drink with an Irishman who's sipping Coke and rum? Don't tell the lads at Shannon's, I'd be shunned for blasphemy. I hate corned beef and cabbage, but I'm Irish as can be. So raise a pint of bitters to the orange and the green, or fill that cup of coffee with some Bailey's Irish Cream. The rocky road to Dublin's many thousand miles away, but here in old Chicago, we're all Irish for a day. I'm known for speaking Gaelic when I've put a few away. I've never had a lesson, but who knows Gaelic anyway? I've never seen Killarney, but I've been to River Dance. I'm off to see the Rovers every time I get the chance. So it's so good to be Irish in the city by the lake. It's good to wear a shamrock and to drink a shamrock shake. My friends will all forgive me if my story's all a lie, but they'll probably throw me a wild party the day after I die. So from Kevin McCarthy, We're All Irish for a Day. And you talk about Blarney or the Blarney Stone, a little history on that. Do you know the meaning of the word Blarney? Well, it endows people with the gift of gab or eloquence in speech. The origins of the word Blarney perhaps come from the time of Cormac MacDermot McCarthy, chief of Blarney Castle, County Cork, in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, around Shakespeare's time. It seems that Cormac used his silver-tongued excuses to placate the queen and her advancing army while still keeping his Gaelic loyalties. The queen eventually grew tired of her smooth-talking subject and declared, "This is all Blarney. He never means what he says. He never does what he promises." So, if you are in search of Blarney, you'll certainly find it on this radio show. This St. Patrick's Day, celebrate at The Gage, where owners Billy and Billy Lawless welcome Chicago's Irish community and those who are just Irish for the day on one of the city's favorite holidays. Two generations of the Lawless family are behind the festive atmosphere at The Gage. They regularly play host to Irish diplomats and even previously welcomed the President of Ireland on this cheerful day. All are invited to enjoy a lineup of authentic menu specials, live music, and good cheer. Located just blocks from the Chicago River, carousers can visit the iconic Michigan Avenue restaurant after watching the traditional river dyeing and parade. Diners will savor Irish fare washed down with a selection of traditional Irish beers, whiskeys, and specialty cocktails. Available during lunch and dinner service, The Gage's St. Patrick's Day menu is available through March 17th. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning restaurateur, widely recognized and loved Chicago celebrity, a leader in the restaurant and hospitality industry in Chicago, a leading activist for immigration reform, the first immigrant senator in the Irish legislature to hold a senatorial seat and live in Chicago, leader in the Irish diaspora, one of the brightest stars in Chicago's dining scene, and with his son Billy, the most welcoming Irishman in Chicago, now celebrating St. Patrick's Day like no one else can at The Gage, 24 South Michigan, our good friend, Mr. William Lawless. Mr. Wallace, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Kevin, thank you very much, Kevin.
It's great to have you. And, of course, we always look forward to this week, as you do. I know you're celebrating already, and we're certainly looking forward to St. Patrick's Day at The Gage.
It's going to be a great weekend, Kevin. It always is. You know, we're here 20 years now.
20 years, really? Okay.
Yep. Yeah, we started in Wrigleyville 21 years ago, actually.
The Irish Oak.
That's correct. And moved downtown there about 11 years ago. Now the Gage is open 11. So we have a bunch of my family's have restaurants downtown. So it's going to be a great weekend. A lot of dignitaries coming in. Our prime minister's coming in. I have three senators, colleagues of mine, coming from the Senate in Dublin also.
Oh, great.
Yeah, there's a bunch of 50 policemen coming in to play rugby.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a big deal coming to Chicago. Really big deal.
Do we have the largest celebration for St. Patrick's Day outside of Ireland?
Oh, it'll be one of the tops, Kevin, without a doubt. Probably New York is so long established. Chicago, everybody wants to come to Chicago. Whatever Chicago has, well, we know what it has. Layback, Midwestern hospitality. It's just a great town. Great, great town.
Do you celebrate this much in Ireland for St. Patrick's Day?
They do. In the last number of years, every little town has its own little parade.
Sure.
Dublin is huge. My own hometown of Galway is a big one as well. Galway itself is a big tourist town all
right.
year round. And next year, by the way, Galway is European Capital of Culture for 2020.
Oh.
So, yeah. So we expect being a lot of Chicagoans to Galway next year. And anyone listening, if they'd like to come, please contact me.
Well, that's interesting. My ancestors from County Clare.
Okay.
County Clare. And, but of course, on St. Patrick's Day, everybody's Irish, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we'd have African Americans coming in dressed in. But of course, you know, Kevin, one of the great things about Ireland at the moment, we're multi-ethnic. We're just as multi-ethnic as Chicago is. And it's just unbelievable to hear African American boys speaking with a Dublin accent. Yeah, I just think it's fantastic.
Well, wasn't at one time, and maybe still, I don't know, wasn't there a Jewish mayor of Dublin?
Yes, where he won the first Jewish mayor's. Oh my God, I can't recall his name now. He was a Jewish mayor of Dublin, absolutely.
Yeah, well, we're very ecumenical in the Catholics here, so we might as well let that happen.
No, I'm telling you, we welcome everybody. Well, don't forget, Kevin, we were, you know, as I always remind our Irish ancestors here, our Irish Americans here. We were the first asylum seekers, Kevin, before the word was even invented.
Okay.
You know, in the 1850s, we had to leave Ireland. A million people died from famine, and a million people took the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a big, and about 30 million Irish, 30 million Americans claim Irish ancestry.
And that's why we were talking about a little earlier, the Irish diaspora, and you are a senator, of course, as I said in the introduction, in the Irish legislature. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was a huge honor, Kevin. The former Prime Minister Taoiseach, as we call him, Inverkinney, appointed me as the first senator, Irish citizen living overseas, to represent the Irish diaspora.
Wow.
They've been talking about it for many years, all governments, actually, and all parties, because we have so many of our people immigrated, and especially to America.
Mm-hmm.
I always regard the United States as Ireland's natural immigrant home.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just an incredible honor. I try and get back there every second month,
mm-hmm.
Because I have good people here. We've great support groups here as well. The Irish government actually spent over $100 million on foreign aid last year for Irish support groups. Worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And we have about 15 Irish support centers throughout the U.S. as well, looking after our Irish citizens. And would you believe it, 40% of the people that one of our centers looked after in Boston are non-Irish.
Really?
So which is very, one thing we're very proud of.
We all came from somewhere, right, Mr. Lawless?
Well, as when I hear of the immigration debates going on here, Kevin, I say to everybody, every single one of us is an immigrant, except the American Indian.
That's right.
You know, everybody else, and those people talking out against immigrants, they're the very ones whose ancestors had to come here,
mm-hmm.
and were given sanctuary there, which I think is fantastic.
And I want to give an explanation or a definition of a diaspora is when a scattered population whose origin lies in a separate geographical locale moves to a different country, the Irish coming over to America, the going back all the way to the Jews when they were expelled from Israel, or a nationality that leaves their home country and comes to another country to start to live. And that's what a diaspora is.
Of course, absolutely. And, you know, that's what this country was built on. You know, the shining light, the beacon on the hill. That's what America stood for. And America and immigrants have made this country great, have made it fantastic. Even as I was a child, I was lucky enough, I was 13 years of age, when John F. Kennedy, President John F. Kennedy at the time, visited my hometown of Galway.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, I had a yen to seek to come to the United States. So something that draws Irish people to the United States. We just have a love of what it stood for and what it did for our people. Back when we had a famine and suffering from starvation and poverty. We will never forget that.
Well, my question, Mr. Lawless, is, you know, you're a senator over in Ireland in the legislature. Why didn't you consider running for mayor of Chicago? We had everybody else run it.
No, I don't think there's any more room.
I got a great campaign headquarters right on Michigan Avenue, 24 South Michigan.
I had the ideal location, but I think a little bit of sense prevailed.
You know, we have such a great time over at the Gage with your son Billy, who is just a fine, fine gentleman, and certainly Patrick Doyle is a great guy who's an integral part of the success of the Gage and all the restaurants that you have, because you have a half a dozen of them now.
Yeah, we have my two daughters at the Deer Barn with myself and Dan, my wife, and we have the Canto next door. Billy's has the Dawson, the Beacon, and Côte de Volte up in Ridgeville.
Right.
So we have a pretty august group of restaurants. So we have all slightly different, but. It's such a great city, Kevin, as well. You know, this is one of the great choices that I made when I came here. Funnily enough, the reason I came here was my youngest daughter got a rowing scholarship to Boston University.
Now, who's that, Amy?
Amy, yes.
Yeah.
And Boston is a big west of Ireland Galway town. You know, a lot of all the different areas in Ireland back in the, 100 years ago or more, they went to various towns in the States. And when I went to Boston, I was actually where we were going to set up. And I came down to Chicago for a weekend, Kevin, and I never left it.
Good. That's good for us. Good for us.
Good choice.
Now, I'm from the south side of Chicago, the Beverly area. So you got to open up restaurants somewhere in the Beverly area, too, you know. A lot of Irishmen down there.
Oh, there are some great things down there. Bill Gaynor, Willie Winters.
Oh, sure. Willie's a great guy. Good friend.
Yeah. A lot of great guys. There's a lot of Irish down in Beverly side. I have cousins. My cousins, the Curtins.
Sure.
Live down there in Evergreen Park.
Sure, sure.
Huge connections there. So, but you look, no matter where you go, Kevin, all the Irish have cousins or relations, no matter what small town.
It's a great big world, but a very small loop.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure.
The Gage is a sprawling, energetic restaurant and tavern that is at 24 South Michigan, an inviting, comfortable place to savor delicious, upscale comfort food, fine wines, boutique beers, and whiskeys, while enjoying the relaxing atmosphere of its vintage decor. And St. Patrick's Day, no better day to celebrate at the Gage, where owners Billy and Billy Lawless and the general manager Patrick Doyle, Chicago's Irish community, welcome everyone, and some who are Irish and some who are just Irish for the day. One of the city's favorite holidays. So remember that this weekend's a big weekend, and on the line with us right now is our good friend, Mr. William Lawless, Senator William Lawless of the Gage. And it's a delight to chat with you, Mr. Lawless. And it was nice meeting Mrs. Lawless, Kay Lawless, the other day at the restaurant.
Absolutely. Oh, she's the boss.
She is. Well, we'll see you this weekend, and thank you for taking a little time to chat. And I want to give a phone number for people when I go on to the Gage, of course, is 312-372-4243. The greatest Irishman in the world, Billy and Billy Lawless.
Thank you very much, Kevin, and happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody.
God bless you. Thank you, Mr. Lawless.
Thanks, Kevin.
Take care. Bye-bye. As I said, we've had Billy Lawless on the show with us many times. It's always a delight, and what an honor to have Mr. Lawless on. What a great, great guy. And again, the first immigrant senator in the Irish legislature to hold a senatorial seat and live in Chicago, and the leader of the Irish diaspora. Just a great, great gentleman. And again, The Gauge, celebrate St. Patrick's Day, 312-372-4243. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me, and I hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guests, Don Winslow, award-winning author whose latest book, The Border, is now out and a must-read. Very engaging conversation about the world of drugs and state of society as it is today. It was an honor to have Don on our show. And Senator William Lawless, with his son Billy and General Manager Patrick Doyle, the proprietors of one of Chicago's great restaurants, The Gauge, at 24 South Michigan, now celebrating St. Patrick's Day. For information, 312-372-4243. Mr. Lawless is the first immigrant senator in the Irish legislature to hold a senatorial seat and live in Chicago. So it was an honor to have him on the show. He's the leader of the Irish diaspora. And again, for information, 312-373-4243 at The Gauge. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought every day at least to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week. And as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. But let me end with an Irish blessing in honor of St. Patrick's Day. May the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. The rains fall soft upon your fields, and until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends, if we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, then any luck, then I suppose the music, the music.